1-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-0-
Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we inform you about a deterrence topic and its value in preserving peace. We hope you enjoy this show.
Hello, everybody. I'm Don Alston, and I'm a NIST Senior Fellow. And I thought I'd ask you to risk 9 minutes of your time to let me engage you with some thoughts on nuclear weapons and leadership. I think my career experience gives me some bona fides to talk about leadership. I've been a missile combat crew commander, an ICBM squadron commander at a time in our history when missile squadrons included launch officers, maintenance, and security forces, growing from the traditional size of about 85 to about 235 personnel. I commanded an ICBM operations group of about 1,500 personnel during a brief time in our history when the group included missile operators and security forces. I've commanded an ICBM wing alone and unafraid up at Malmstrom with about 4,500 personnel, and then including all their families. And my last position was leading the ICBM Alert Force as the 20th Air Force Commander. My perspective on Alert Force readiness was shaped during my formative years in Strategic Air Command, when both bomber and missile forces were all on nuclear alert and we were producing deterrence on a sufficient scale to preclude a massive nuclear attack from the Soviet Union. It was a time when those same units would learn that the SAC Inspector General was en route when they were notified his airplane was 30 minutes away from landing at your base. And on board was some vice wing commander ready to be installed if the wing commander got fired as a result of failing the inspection. Performing under conditions of constant evaluation with its attendant components of pressure and fear gave SAC-trained killers many a story to tell and produced leaders who could depend on a deep bench to produce the next man up. Of course, it doesn't take a lot of leadership skill to solve problems with just a personnel change. Overall, it taught me that an alert force demands special leadership attention. A lot has changed over the three decades since SAC faded into history. One thing that has not changed is the ICBM alert force, or I should say the ICBM force on alert. What about the threat? I'm persuaded that the odds of a hostile nuclear detonation occurring in my lifetime are not zero. I am persuaded that the demands of deterring Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran make a compelling case for having an unblinking, credible first strike deterrent. My comments today are directed towards leading within units with nuclear alert responsibilities. There aren't any special skills that reveal themselves only to those within the relatively small ICBM community. I was once asked for a suggestion on a topic for a senior service school project, and I said, why don't you look at how leadership may be different between military units with nuclear weapons and those with a conventional mission? The outstanding officer took this on, did a fantastic job creating a line of inquiry with very detailed questions to tease out any differences, and then did exhaustive interviews across a broad range of mission sets. And ultimately, his conclusion is, there's no difference. Now, I had partnered with the author, reviewing his approach and questions he was evolving, but despite this proximity to his process and the quality of his scholarship, I didn't like the conclusion. The essential shortfall in that study is that the ICBM mission includes nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons make everything different. All the people are screened and constantly monitored to enable their daily performance near these weapons. Initial and recurring certifications abound to enable work in this mission area. Teams perform all actions. No one works alone in proximity to these weapons. Oversight of a flight line measured in tens of thousands of miles is different. A 24-year-old team chief and a 19-year-old team member are authorized and required to drive 100 miles to penetrate a launch facility where an on-alert nuclear weapon is plugged into a Minuteman III ICBM, most of the time without additional supervision on site. Deterrence is manufactured every day by the completion of hundreds of essential tasks by tens of teams. As a wing commander, I worried that this constant tempo involving so many moving parts, performing often recurring common tasks, made me think that I may be the only person using the word nuclear in a sentence every day. I think there are three key concepts that are constantly in play that are recognized by the most effective leaders at all levels in a nuclear unit, and they involve risk, trust, and consequence. Back in the summer of 2007, in the immediate aftermath of mistakenly transporting nuclear weapons from Minot to Barksdale, the senior leader was quoted in the press as saying, quote, "We do not manage risk in the nuclear business, we eliminate it," end quote. This, of course, is BS. Some level of risk is ever present, and it needs to be recognized, understood, and mitigated. I've never been satisfied that we aggressively try to understand mission risk and then have a thoughtful way to mitigate that risk. Soon after I took command of the 12th Missile Squadron, the wing underwent a nuclear surety inspection. The only missile crew in the wing to fail to meet the performance standard was one of mine. I could have looked at that and felt that it was a one-off. It was an isolated incident. Just retrain the crew and move on. Here comes leadership lesson number one. I've been blessed or cursed with a propensity to want to exhaustively do linear regression against a single visible data point. I approach a problem that has surfaced to represent a trend that I had thus far failed to identify. Over the next few months, after looking at testing, training, and evaluation data, I became convinced I had a systemic problem. As a result, I went rogue, well, relative to my fellow squadron commanders, and began no-notice evaluations of my crew. During the next nuclear surety inspection, only the Red Dogs passed every pressure-packed evaluation. Leaders at all levels need to brutally examine current readiness and project what could adversely affect future readiness. How ready are you today? How do you know? How ready will you be in 6 months? How will you know? Only the inexperienced, the uncurious, or arrogant will assume stronger readiness in the future just because they're in charge. Leadership lesson number two involves trust. Let's face it, major industrial operations with complex equipment, lots of people and parts in motion, and nuclear weapons sometimes require close oversight of certain activities. Risk needs to be understood and mitigated, and experts are on hand watching operations to help ensure success. But even in a nuclear unit, the level of oversight is the exception and not the rule. That level of oversight is the exception, not the rule. Certified people are trusted to do their jobs. But leadership at all levels needs to be personally engaged to verify the worthiness of that trust. One day I was visiting a work center, and I was watching a young man perform a maintenance activity, and I loved this moment when he said to me, "Sir, you came to watch us do this job just a couple of months ago, and now you're back. Don't you trust us?" I bent down to get closer to him, and I said, "Man, if I didn't trust you, you wouldn't be working today. The reality is I love you, and I want to tell the world how good you are. So why don't you show me one more time?" Sometimes you're inspired with just the right words. So good leaders are out and about showing their interest, but just showing up is not enough. Be there during the routine and the special activities. Don't be afraid to watch high consequence operations. The people are well-trained and well-led. And besides, you have to know for yourself. Verifying the trust you have in your people is important to them and to you. The third concept is ensuring everyone recognizes the shared consequences of doing deterrence well and fortifying national security. And on the flip side, falling short on any given day at the expense of that day's deterrence effort. I'll close the podcast with some words I wrote in my 20th Air Force Vector during my final assignment. Unlike almost all missions in our Air Force, the alert force is at near maximum generation every day in our combat positions, working directly for our warfighting combatant command, U.S. Strategic Command, employing nuclear weapons every day as we constantly execute the deterrence mission. There is not substantially more demanded of the ICBM force and higher DEFCONs than in day-to-day posture. The near constant training and preparation for crisis plus daily operations drive the credibility of the strategic deterrent, and that credibility precludes the crossing of the nuclear threshold. This is the single most significant distinguishing characteristics of an on-alert nuclear force compared to all other Air Force mission areas. The destructive power and political significance of nuclear weapons, especially those that are on alert, compel us to train, evaluate, and operate to uniquely high and demanding nuclear surety standards. Deterrence is the mission. It is the effect we provide. Surety is a set of standards which defines our operational environment and how we deter. The elite ICBM force must meet these standards at all times. Major General Tim McMahon, a former 20th Air Force commander, a mentor and a friend of mine, said it well. In its essence, nuclear surety comes down to the stewards of nuclear weapons providing two guarantees. First, we guarantee the President of the United States that if he directs, that we will strike and produce a nuclear yield. to produce a nuclear yield, then we will do so precisely as directed. Second, we guarantee the people of the United States that absent that order, the weapons in our custody are safe, they are secure, and they are reliable. If we cannot deliver on the first guarantee, then the force is politically and militarily irrelevant. If we cannot deliver on the second guarantee, then the existence of the force and the weapons themselves are intolerable. The stewards of those two guarantees are the men and women committed to the Nuclear Alert Force mission, and those men and women who lead them. Thank you.
A production of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies.